I'm Michael White in Manchester Central, the conference arena where excitement is building ahead of the leader's speech this afternoon. It was his virtuoso performance, roaming the stage without notes, that secured David Cameron the Conservative leadership in Blackpool 4 years ago. Now, having only been in Parliament since 2001, he has Downing Street in his sights. I'm here with The Guardian's leader writer, Julian Glover, but before we hear from him, here's our chief political correspondent, Nick Watt.
Well, this afternoon, David Cameron will be closing the Conservative conference, and his speech is going to really strike quite a different tone to what we've had through the week. The other big speech of the week was, of course, George Osborne's speech. He didn't smile during that speech, and it was a pretty grim message. He's going to say that I'm ready to be Prime Minister. His words will be, I'm ready for that, and so I believe are the British people. But then he's going to say it's going to be very tough. He says, I will be tested. There is a steep climb ahead. But the final thing he'll say, and I think he regards this as the most important, is he'll try to sort of revive the spirit of Ronald Reagan's famous election campaign in 1984, the famous Morning in America, where he was upbeat and optimistic. And David Cameron will say, yes, it's a steep climb ahead, but I can tell you this, the view from the summit will be worth it. And what he's trying to say is we have grim times ahead, and I know I'm going to have to navigate us through these very difficult times. But when we get there, life will be better, life will be sunnier under a Conservative government.
Now, Julian Glover's here. Julian, what's Cameron got to do with his speech today?
He's got to tell them they're going to win, but not look overconfident. He's got to tell them that things are going to be difficult in government, but it'll go somewhere. In the end, there is a bright hope for the party, for Britain, under a Cameron government. It's not just austerity. And he's also got to convey a message that he leads a team that's a government. He doesn't just lead an opposition. He's got to really look responsible and serious. And finally, one other thing they've been trying to do this week is draw together the two themes of the time he's been leader, the early period, if we put it like that, which was progressive, kind, hugging trees, loving huskies, and the second period, which was the nasty, swinging cuts. And he needs to draw that together into one narrative.
Before and after the recession.
Before and after the recession. And the aim of what they're trying to do in the speech, I think, is to bring together those two themes into one sort of message. This is what the Cameron government's going to be like. It'll be progress, but it'll also be tough.
Okay. Now, that's what he's got to say to the party faithful. It's a cliche of conference reporting that his party leader always has two audiences. One in the hall, very important. The people are going to do all the work, stuff the letterboxes with leaflets and pound the pavements. And the other is the electorate who will decide the outcome of that leaflet stuffing and pavement pounding. What's he got to say to voters? Same thing or a different message?
I think to voters the question he's got is, does he address expenses head on? In the last two party conferences at Labour and the Liberal Democrats, people really evaded that issue. They didn't talk about the crisis of the spring. It was nodded to dutifully, but nobody confronted it. Does Cameron really present himself as a party that's different? The old politics is going out of the window because they're worried that in the next few months there'll be more details and more expenses coming out. He doesn't want to get dragged down back into the mire. Does he take a line now and say, we're really going to be tough if more comes out? Does he address that issue? The other maybe for the party is, does he just reassure them he is a Conservative? He's not just the heir to Blair. I think this week's gone well for that. The party likes him much more at the end of it than they have at the end of other conferences.
My assumption has been that come the election, because the result isn't certain, we are going to get a much bigger turnout than 61% last time, 59% the time before. I think that's a pretty crucial test of what's going to happen next
year. It is, and that goes to the thing you say there. It's about change. There is a possibility that if you vote, you have the feeling you're beginning to choose one of two governments, which wasn't the case, at least in the last two elections, when the outcome was obvious. Mm. So Cameron's essential need is to look like the change. And it's the most boring thing to sit here in this hall and hear the word change used all the time, see it on every banner. It seems an empty, almost meaningless word. But it is the essence of what they need to look like if they are going to win that election.
But it's going to be a different sort of change. Well, we'll find out from David Cameron later today. Well, we've bumped into Danny Finkelstein, who I first knew when he was a bright young thing working for David Owen in the SDP, and then he dramatically defected to the Conservatives in, was it 92 or 92? 92,
it was,
wasn't it?
Undramatically, yeah, joining the Conservatives after David had stopped.
But there were lots of you, weren't there?
There were.
There
yes.
was a very dramatic yes. scene. Anyway, that was then. He stood for Parliament. He didn't get in. He went to work for The Times, where he writes a very lively, smart column about football and politics and many other things, and does the polling for them as well as Right Leaders. He's tipped to go back to Downing Street if the Tories win. What should David Cameron do today when he makes a speech? What's his task with his party and with the watching electorate, Danny?
I believe he's got to hit the idea that he is the change. They're going to run, "It's time for a change," is their election slogan. The big danger to that is everyone thinks you're all the same. all
because
the parties
of what's happened
the
in the last
and
year.
And I think, so. I think that is intensified greatly by what's happened in the last year. Mm-hmm. In my view, the expenses row was a little bit about who bought whose spatula, but it was also about a feeling of disillusion with politicians and politics, and therefore what David Cameron's got to do is show he gets that. It's very difficult, of course, for him to make people feel that MPs are wonderful and they're worth all the money they're being paid. That is a massive task. I don't expect him to solve that problem, but I do expect him or think that it is his big task to project that he understands that he gets that national mood. I thought it was a big mistake of Gordon Brown to relegate that section of his speech so far back and not to make it a theme of his offering, that you should trust it, because all the politicians' promises, everything that they say they're going to do, hit up against the wall that people simply don't believe them.
Even when people are actually wrong. I mean, I often feel that by the time what politicians are trying to say has been mediated by people like you and me in the media, little wonder that voters don't believe them. But voters are pretty ungenerous. They pocket the successes and then they say,
absolutely,
what are you going to give me next?
But you can't, you know, the Conservative Party tried very hard. I worked for it while it did so, to sack its voters. This proved an unyielding strategy. And you politicians cannot do that. They have to listen to the electorate. If they don't want to regard the electorate as their best possible employer, then they shouldn't allow themselves to be employed by the electorate.
Right, so The Guardian, other people have done the same thing. Show pictures of leading members of the shadow cabinet to people outside in the street, outside the Ring of Steel this week, and they don't recognise them, not even George Osborne.
Well, it's a big ask, to use that dreadful football phrase, to expect them to recognise pictures of the cabinet, let alone the shadow cabinet. People just aren't that interested. The different question is, are these people actually any good? And the truth is, it's a patchy picture. And you watch the stage and you think some of them are better than others.
And you never know how good they are until they actually do it,
yes,
is my
absolutely.
Experience. Thank you very much. Danny Finkelstein of The Times. As anyone around here will tell you, despite a handsome lead in the polls, the Conservatives still face an anxious struggle to win. They need to take 117 seats just to form a government because the way the boundaries are drawn gives Labour a built-in advantage and piles up Tory votes in constituencies where they don't need them. And it's post-industrial Labour heartlands like this one in the northwest that are likely to be most resistant to a Cameron government. I ventured outside the conference arena's Ring of Steel here in central Manchester, took my life in my hands to test the mood and find out whether local people not connected with the conference are actually taking any notice of it.
Unfortunately, I can't say I have.
No, that's all right. Probably most people haven't. Do you think there's going to be a Conservative government in the next election?
Possibly.
Do you think it's time for a change yourself?
Yes, definitely.
What do you think of
not
David
really.
Cameron? You got an impression of him yet?
Oh, I think he's quite good, actually.
What do you like about him?
He's quite charismatic, I think.
Okay.
So,
I'm sure he'd like that answer. We're from the Guardian Media Unit. We're just stopping and asking people, have they listened to the Tory conference at all down the road this week?
No.
Not at all. Who do you think's going to win the election?
Don't know if I really care, to be honest.
Don't you? Do you not vote?
I haven't done so far, no.
Gosh. How old are you?
31.
Gosh, you've had a lots of votes you haven't voted in. Well, you're obviously the wrong person to ask. Do you know who David Cameron is?
Yes, I do, yes.
He's the fellow doing his stuff down there. Have you any impression of him at all?
To be honest, I don't pay too much attention
no.
to it all.
Okay, so the answer is no.
Not really, no.
Okay, thank you very much.
Excuse me, sir. We're asking people whether they've been following the Tory conference down the road this week.
Yes, certainly have, both through the newspapers and the radio.
What do you think of it all?
I think it's good for Manchester that they've come here. It's a lot of people, mm-hmm. obviously, spending a lot of money.
A few bob in the tills, yes.
Yeah.
But what about the question of the politics of it all? Are you impressed by what you've seen?
Yes, I am, I think, compared to how they were a few years ago.
Are you normally a sort of Conservative voter or a Labour-Liberal sort of voter?
I probably tend to lean from Liberal towards the Tories.
So you might be switching from Liberals to the Tories. Is that about David Cameron or about the
party? Yeah, I'm impressed with David Cameron.
What do you like about him?
I just think he seems to connect with people. I think he's got a good attitude, and I think although people keep saying they don't know what the Tories stand for, I think... you know, they're giving out quite a good impression of what they'd do if they did form the next government.
So you're expecting a Conservative government too, are you?
I'm expecting one. I'm not sort of particularly looking forward to that.
Because?
I don't know, just because recent their legacy.
Legacy from 12 years ago?
Legacy of, yeah.
Margaret Thatcher, you mean?
Yeah.
Still remember her?
Still remember her because I think...
20 years nearly since she was in charge of the show.
Yeah, I feel politics since her has been her legacy. You know, Labour was a result of Margaret Thatcher. Tony Blair, Gordon Brown are Margaret Thatcher's legacy, in my opinion.
Well, you mean too pro-free market?
Yes.
Yesterday's agenda was dominated by social issues, law and order, families, welfare reform and education, all bracketed under the heading Mending Our Broken Society. Once upon a time, speakers would receive rapturous applause for recommending bringing back the rope and extra prison, but these are, so we're told, modern conservatives with modern views. However, when Michael Gove took to the stage, he wasted no time before lampooning current standards in GCSE results.
We ask students in GCSE science, which is a better argument for nuclear power? Creating jobs or creating toxic waste? We ask students in GCSE science, which is healthier? A battered sausage or a grilled fish? These aren't rigorous tests of scientific knowledge. They're terrifying evidence of how our educational establishment has presided over a comprehensive decline in examination standards. What should we do with people who think that this country can become a scientific leader by asking about sausages in batter? They've just got to go.
With that in mind, our education editor, Polly Curtis, put it to the shadow school secretary that his education policy is traditionalist rather than progressive.
I think it's important to recognise that the phrase progressive is probably one of the most promiscuously used phrases in the English language. But progressive education has come to mean a particular approach which is antithetical to knowledge, opposed to traditional subjects, and which downplays the role of the teacher and sees the child essentially discovering facts and knowledge and the world for itself with the teacher as a sort of learning coach. Now, I think that's wrong. I think that what we crucially need to do is to recognise that the sort of knowledge-based curriculum divided into appropriate subjects with teachers who have deep subject knowledge and a passion for the subject that brought them into education, that sort of approach is right. I don't think that's traditional, because actually those schools which have had the opportunity to move outside bureaucratic control have adopted it, and those schools which are in America, for example, like the KIPP schools, the Knowledge is Power Programme schools, doing their best to transform the life chances of black and minority ethnic children, they adopt that approach. So tried and tested, yes. Traditional, well, you know, different people will take a different approach to that phrase.
One of your arguments for academies and for freeing up paying conditions is to allow schools to pay teachers more. How do you square that with a pay freeze?
Because we recognise that the total wage bill for teaching has to stay static because the extra money isn't there. But within the resources that we give to schools, it's appropriate that heads and others should be able to exercise appropriate discretion. If you look at any good organisation, then it devolves responsibility down to strong managers, and therefore we want to devolve responsibility down to heads to use that money as creatively as they think. If they can find, through generating efficiencies in other areas, ways of ensuring that teachers can be supported, and indeed that teachers can be supported through continuous professional development, then fantastic.
Are you expecting a fight with the unions over all of this?
I really enjoy all the conversations I have with trade unions. And Chris Keats, Christine Blower, Mary Boosted, John Dunford, Mick Brooks, all committed to improving state education. So I'm looking forward to working with them and harnessing their enthusiasm for improving state education if we're fortunate enough to be entrusted with government.
Michael Gove talking there to Polly Curtis. So, I'm sure David Cameron has had an early night, no champagne, he went off that yesterday, and will be in calm, firm fettle, light lunch, not too much coffee, ready to speak this afternoon. I'll be back tomorrow with all the reaction from the hall and analysis from the Guardian's team of experts. Until then, goodbye.